for someone to take a seat.
Many times the children were inspected like they were livestock. Muscles were felt. Teeth were checked. Sometimes the children would sing or dance trying to attract the attention of new mothers and fathers. It was frightening to have complete strangers looking them over and touching them. If they were lucky, someone chose them. Papers were signed, and they went home with their new parents. While a local committee made sure that the new parents were fit to be parents, it was not much of an inspection compared to today. For 75 years, so-called orphan trains brought uncared for or unwanted children, ranging from infants in age to teenagers, brought them to strangers in the West. I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air. Today, it may be hard to believe that children would be turned over to people they had never met, hundreds of miles from home, would have to market themselves to prospective parents with little or no oversight from the community. But those orphan trains ran for 75 years or so, carrying upwards of 200,000 children into the hands of strangers. What was the thinking behind orphan trains? How well did they do what they were intended to do, and what became of all those children? We'll find out from my guest, Clark Kidder, author of Orphan Trains and Their Precious Cargo and Emily's Story, The Brave Journey of an Orphan Train Rider. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman.
I know you have a personal stake in this, too, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But the orphan trains, what got you interested in them? Because they really seem to be, even now, relatively little known.
Well, as I was growing up, my grandmother, my paternal grandmother, Emily Reese Kidder, would often talk about how she was brought out on a train by a minister in New York City, and how she'd been placed in an orphanage in Brooklyn as a young girl, and placed in several foster homes here in the Midwest after she came out on the train. Not long after she passed away, I started to hear about these orphan trains. And the Orphan Train Heritage Society of America was formed, and I read about that, and I thought, certainly, my grandmother must have been part of this mass migration of children they were talking about based on the stories she told us. And not long after, my aunt contacted me to let me know that a lady in our hometown of Milton, Wisconsin, had the journals and scrapbooks that were kept by this minister that had brought my grandma out on the train. And sure enough, her file number was recorded at the Children's Aid Society in New York that had sent her out, and the minister had glued in her wedding photo and recorded quite a bit of information about her.
We'll get to him later, too, but I gather then that he took out a number of children. Did he take them out one at a time on these trains, or how did that work?
Well, these groups of children would go out from the groups could range in size from anywhere between a half dozen and 150. There was quite a wide range in the size of these groups of kids. There were about 9 sent out in the group that my grandmother came out with.
What was the impetus for these trains? You mentioned New York already, and I gather that was quite a source for a lot of uncared for, really, vagabond children.
Yes, nearly all of these children originated in orphanages or on the streets of New York City. Boston sent out a lot of kids, too, on the orphan trains. The Home for Little Wanderers in Boston was the source there. But in New York City, it was the Children's Aid Society and the New York Foundling Hospital that sent the vast majority of these children out on the trains.
And we're talking about, I guess, the 1850s at this point. What did they do with excess children before that?
Well, prior to that, many of these little kids were thrown in prisons and incarcerated with adults. You know, it's hard to believe now, but, you know, children as young as 6 were thrown in these prisons and housed with adult prisoners, you know, or just left to fend for themselves on the streets, of course.
Did the situation, the numbers change dramatically as we get into the 1850s and the decades right after?
Well, yes, the things began to change numbers-wise when more immigrants began arriving in New York City. A lot of these kids would get separated from their family, you know, after they got off the ships. Thousands would arrive daily from primarily from Germany and Ireland. And these kids would get separated. There wasn't the extended family structure there to, there wasn't an aunt or an uncle or a cousin that could take a child in if the mom or dad perished on the journey over to America or shortly thereafter.
And who came up with the idea then for the orphan trains? I mean, there were orphanages, but I gather they just were not able to cope with this great influx. So somebody comes up with this idea of the orphan train.
Exactly. It all began with a young minister named Charles Loring Brace, who was born in Hartford, Connecticut, and educated there. He thought that a ministry would be his calling, but he soon found himself working at the famous Five Points Mission in New York City.
Five Points, a notorious gang place even back in the 1850s.
That's right. That's right. You know, he was appalled by what he's seen in the form of all these thousands of homeless children living on the streets. And he traveled extensively in Europe, and he observed a practice over there that they called transportation, in which thousands of England's undesirable citizens were shipped off to Australia, Cape Town, and even North America. And he thought that surely something similar could be done to deal with the throngs of homeless children in America.
Well, of course, transportation is one thing. If you're sending an adult to Australia, you just kind of let them fend for themselves. But you can't just put children on a plane or a train in this case and send them west and hope for the best.
Exactly. And, well, Brace really thought that the farmer's home was the most desirable place to send these children to. And, not long after he founded the Children's Aid Society, he actually founded it in March of 1854. And he enlisted the help of agents to accompany these children on the train so they weren't alone, and would make arrangements in the towns prior to the trains being sent out.
So that people would be expecting them. You know, we talk about all of the children who were on the street fending for themselves, but there's also a situation that I guess has almost been forgotten. And that is that apparently some of the churches actually had baskets. They had these repositories where mothers would put their unwanted newborns or newborns that they couldn't take care of.
They did indeed. And the Children's Aid Society was a Protestant organization. The Catholic version, if you will, was the New York Foundling Hospital, founded in 1869 by Sister Irene. The very night that they opened this foundling hospital, a little baby was left on their front stoop. And there were soon so many arriving every day that they decided they'd put a wicker baby buggy out in the front lobby to receive these children. The mothers would come sometimes in the middle of the night and deposit the baby in the basket.
And another sort of classic situation, which I suppose has been largely forgotten, is these letters that the mothers would sometimes leave with the babies. We have a couple of them that you brought in. This one says,
"Dear sister, alone and deserted, I need to put my little one with you for a time. I would willingly work and take care of her, but no one will have me and her too. All say they would take me if she was 2 or 3 years old. So not knowing what to do with her, and not being able to pay her board, I bring her to you, knowing you will be as kind to her as to the many others who are under your care. And I will get work, and try hard to be able to relieve you of the care when I can take her to work with me. She is only 3 weeks old, and I have not had her christened or anything."
So this is a mother who is hoping that she'll actually get the child back, and you wonder whether that ever happened or not.
Yes, one has to wonder.
And here's another one left by a mother in Brooklyn and dated. The previous one was 1875. This is November 23rd, 1869.
"Dear sister,
I now sit down to write to you a few lines, but I hardly know what to say, for when I inform you that I am the mother of the child, left on Thanksgiving night between the hours of 8 and 9 o'clock, without even a slip of paper to tell you the name of the child left in your care, my heart aches so much I cannot tell, but I knew that I was leaving her in good hands. Although I have been unfortunate, I am neither low nor degraded, and am in hopes of one day claiming my child. Her name is Jane, born on the 5th of October, 1869, between the hours of 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning. She had a piece of Canton flannel tied around her head, and a little blue and white cloud wrapped around her, and little red and white socks on her feet. And if the prayers of an unfortunate creature like myself will do any good, offered to the mercy of God in heaven, know that every night on my bended knees I pray for you. I am very sorry that I have nothing to send you this time, but I am in hopes there will be a day when I shall be able to pay you for all your trouble.
And indeed, the letter is articulate. This is, a woman who seems to have been well educated, but has, for whatever reason, just fallen on hard times.
Yes, yes, indeed. They're very heart-wrenching stories and really could be written today by many mothers if it weren't for the fact that they have a place to go with the children and programs to support them, you know.
Do you have a sense that there was a political issue or issues involved with these orphan trains?
Well, I've never heard that there was, to be honest. I think that Brace and, of course, the Foundling Home decided that something just needed to be done, you know, to help these children out, and they had good intentions.
Was there anybody saying, wait a minute, is this really a good idea?
Well, eventually there was, yes. Eventually, you know, many states enacted laws prohibiting the children from even being brought into their state. Wisconsin very early on did so, late 1880s, I believe, and had some rather strong words to say against these children. One legislator referred to them as vermin, you know, and I think they really believed that they had bad blood, if you will, and would inherit all these troubles that so many of the parents had suffered from.
Well, that was another interesting phenomenon of the times, the interpretation or misinterpretation of the writings of Charles Darwin, and this whole effort to just manage more closely in some institutional way how people interacted.
Yes, indeed.
So these trains, the first ones then, 1850s, head west and to specific towns where people have been notified that there will be, how did they put it, free children that you can pick up, and how many do you get if you want one?
Well, the Children's Aid Society would have local ministers screen potential foster parents prior to the arrival of the train, but they were more utilized in the form of a committee that would be put together that consisted of these ministers, and they would secure a venue, decide on a date and time, and the foster parents would be asked to show up that day. Sometimes 300 people would show up and come from as far away as 30 miles to pick out a child. And it was customary to take one child per household. Very little in the way of background checks were ever done on these kids, especially the ones sent out by the Children's Aid Society. Siblings were often separated because the family couldn't afford to take more than one child. So it caused some pretty heart-wrenching scenes, you know, at these distributions.
You're being separated from your brother or sister without knowing where they're going and certainly not knowing if you'd ever see them again.
Exactly. And many never did reunite, we've learned through the years as these orphans began to tell their stories. Now, the New York Foundling Hospital operated a little differently than the Children's Aid Society. They would have the priest in the town or city locate these foster parents prior to the coming of the train, and the child would be sent out with a number on their lapel, and the name of their foster parents would literally be handwritten on a piece of cloth and sewn into the collar on their coat.
And you have quotation from one of those foster parents, which is actually, even today, reads a little amusing.
Yes, yes. One new father made this comment. He says, "Beats the stork all hollow. We asked for a boy of 18 months with brown hair and blue eyes, and the bill was filled to the last specification. Why, the young rascal even has my name tacked on him."
And was any check, background check, done on the parents?
The priest did their best, I think. Certainly not the type of background check one might expect would be done today. And the Children's Aid Society didn't get very good marks for the background checks that they did. They fell quite a bit short of the Foundling Hospital in that regard.
Was Charles Loring Brace's idea that, well, the odds notwithstanding that a child would not do well, this child is probably better off in some kind of a family situation than just running wild on the streets of New York or Boston?
This is true. I think for the vast majority of these kids, it was a much better situation than being left in New York on the streets or in these crowded, regimented orphanages. You know, it was just, in many later state, that it was the best thing that ever happened to them.
And there was apparently quite the market for boys and girls both in these places out in the West, farms, I assume, mostly.
Yes, the vast majority went to farms. Of course, early on, the preference was for a young man or young boy, you know, over the age of, say, 9, 10. So they were old enough to work on the farm and help out, you know. And, of course, it made a lot of people suspicious of their motives for taking a child because of this. The Foundling Hospital would never send a child over the age of about 5 out, and their trains were referred to as the baby trains as a result of this. The Children's Aid Society would not send a child any older than 14 on the trains. My grandmother was 13 when she was sent.
And what was the logic behind that?
Well, they just decided that a child any older was just not reformable. You know, they were too set in their ways.
Yeah. And of course, this was before, I think almost in all cases, before you had much for child labor laws.
Oh, yeah. So way before any child labor laws came to be. You know, children as young as 6 or 7 were working in coal mines and factories, going to work with their parents, you know. And it's just hard to fathom in today's day and age, you know.
What about the kids that didn't get picked, and what was the process actually for, you know, for choosing the kids? How did they, in effect, get marketed?
Well, the Children's Aid Society would send these kids out on the train and say, "Hey, we're going to be here on this day at this time," and just told everybody to show up, and then they could take their pick, basically.
It's kind of like getting puppies or
yes,
something.
Yes. In fact, one of the little kids later said it was just like picking out a puppy, or I felt like a cow being inspected. You know, they would peel their lips back and check their teeth and feel their upper arms, you know, and inspect them like you would livestock in many cases.
What were they looking for in girls in particular?
Well, I think in girls, there were a few comments made by the minister that brought my grandmother out on the train in his journals about how many people wanted a little girl to show off or doll up. And this was the motive, I think, for a lot of the girls being taken, or they needed a housekeeper.
And yeah. We assume there may actually have been some childless couples who just wanted to, you know, a young person in the house.
Yes, yes. They may have just had a preference for a young girl.
Well, we'll look further at these orphan trains and hear some of the stories of the children who traveled them when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Thank you.
The minister that brought my grandma out on the orphan train, Reverend Clark, recorded one of these instances in his journals, and he writes, "Not having enough children to satisfy all of the applicants at New Sharon, Iowa in 1904, I received an application for a child that read like this. Mr. Clark, I want a little girl with curly black hair and black eyes, pleasant features, good form, a good singer, and a good memory so as to take part in Sunday school concerts. Oh, and a complexion that will not tan or freckle in the sun." I never found the child, Reverend Clark wrote.
Reverend Clark describing one of the, I guess you could call it an order for one of the children that he would be delivering via the orphan trains, trains that carried children unwanted or uncared for, mostly from big cities in the east out west, and that mostly to the farm families who needed either boys as laborers or girls for some function in the home, or in this case, just, well, it seemed almost for decoration. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Clark Kidder, who has written a couple of books about those orphan trains. What other roles do we know that girls would have played in these orphan trains? And were they in less demand than boys?
They tended to be in less demand, yes. You know, as I said, I believe they were taken, you know, many of them just to have an extra hand on the farm or a housekeeper. Certainly there were some taken for legitimate reasons and for very good reasons. It's really hard to say now what the thinking was, you know, that these foster parents had.
Oh, well, somewhat different for each set of parents, no doubt. What about the children who didn't get picked?
Well, especially with the Children's Aid Society, not so much with the New York Foundling Home. The Foundling Home would prearrange, the foster parents would be predetermined.
To make sure that child was going to somebody
exactly.
Who wanted him or her.
So it was very uncommon for them to get cast aside, if you will, and not accepted upon their arrival.
Oh, now, really?
Right. This was a problem with the Children's Aid Society trains because they didn't pre-screen and predetermine the names of the foster parents like the New York Foundling Hospital did. And these poor kids, you know, if they didn't look just right, would get sent back to New York or put back on the train and sent to the next town and hope to get placed just with a family there.
Keep traveling west.
Yes. Many went on to three or four towns, got passed over time and again, and eventually ended up back in New York. And you can imagine the
devastation.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, first of all, put in the train and away from everything you know, and then going through this selection process and never getting picked.
Exactly. Yeah, it had to be terribly traumatic. And many of these poor little kids got very excited about the prospects of a new mommy and daddy and getting out of these horrible, crowded, regimented orphanages in New York. And their hopes and dreams were just shattered when they were passed over.
But you say some of them actually wound up back in the city?
They literally were sent back to the orphanage that they initially came from. The orphanage would house these children until they were of age, typically, and then would cast them out onto the street with, you know, very little education, no
means of support.
Exactly, right.
So then they had, instead of a problem with lots of children, they had a problem with lots of young adults.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Which I suppose went more into the court system than the
indeed
child care system.
Yes.
We have a fair number of accounts, then, of these children who went out on the orphan trains, I mean, after they grew up?
We do. As with my grandma, so many of them didn't talk a lot about their experiences to family and friends. There was a certain stigma, you know, and back then you just didn't talk about such things like we do now. And my grandma would talk very little about her experiences. Now, after the Orphan Train Heritage Society of America was formed, a lot of these little children now adults and quite aged, began to talk about their experiences. And several books were published that recorded their own stories. But, you know, these kids would get teased in school because they were orphans. And there was, as I said, just such a stigma that, you know, this is why very little was said back in the day and until very recently.
So we have, I gather, then pretty late in the chronology of orphan trains, we have kind of a flood of these reminiscences all of a sudden as we get into the early 20th century.
Exactly, yeah.
And you actually have two or three of them here. We should probably start with some of the reminiscences of your grandmother. So what was her background?
Well, my grandmother was born in 1892 in Brooklyn, New York. And when she was just 3 or 4 years old, her father deserted their family and left her mother with all 10 kids to care for herself. And unable to do so, several of the kids were placed in orphanages there in the Brooklyn area. My grandmother was placed in the Home for Destitute Children on Sterling Place in Brooklyn with her brother Richard, who was 2 years older than she. And Richard was adopted within a few years by a wealthy couple in the area. And my grandmother didn't fare as well. She stayed in that orphanage for many, many years, and finally in 1906 found herself on board one of these orphan trains, initially headed to Hopkinton, Iowa.
And she has in her reminiscences, several things to say about her experiences there. She says,
"I was 9 and a half years old. Mother couldn't support us, so she had to sign a contract to give us up. So in January 1905, we were getting ready for a trip out west. So my brothers and I were taken from this orphanage, accompanied by other boys and girls from various orphanages in Brooklyn. So there were 17 altogether. Before we left Brooklyn, we went to a children's aid society where we stayed 2 days. We were taught table manners and dressed in civilian clothes. We were each given a complete outfit of clothes. I remember what I wore on that trip: a brown coat with a cape and brass buttons, a Buster Brown hat in red. I can't remember the dress shoes or underclothes. They must have been pretty new and nice, as I felt like a princess. Also, at the Children's Aid Society, we had instructions of how to care for ourselves, such as bathing, brushing our teeth daily, how to lace our shoes, and such. We didn't know where we were going. We had a man and lady accompany us. We rode the train. I don't remember too much about the trip, how we ate or slept on the train. I do remember we stopped overnight in Chicago. We had sandwiches, which was a treat. We landed in Rockport, Missouri. It's a small town in northwest Missouri. We went to the Opera House as soon as we arrived, which was about noon. The Opera House was full of people who came to see and take us home with them. It was lunchtime, so our chaperones asked the people to take us to their homes for lunch, then go back to the Opera House for the people to choose who they wanted to take home and give them a home.
So you got it, your child on sort of approval there.
Yes. Yes, you could decide over lunch if they were going to be a good fit or not. And that was a quote from Mamie Gunderson, who was in the same orphanage that my grandmother Emily was in there in Brooklyn, the Home for Destitute Children.
She has some other observations that or recollections about that experience, too. And this, I think, so after lunch, which I hope was pleasant for most of them, they go back to the Opera House and get down to business. And this is what Mamie Gunderson has to say.
"All of the children sat in rows on the stage. Next to me was a girl named Sarah Connett. She had a twin brother, Sammy. When the people were called to come up to the stage and make their choice, there was a real old-looking man who had a long white beard and bushy white hair. His name was E.J. Million. When Sarah and I saw him, she said, 'I hope I don't go home with him,' and I said the same. but he did pick out Sarah, and she started crying and said, "I won't go without Sammy, my brother." So it happened another man, whose name was Hughes, said, "I'll take the both." Then the old man took me. I didn't show any signs of being disappointed, so I went with him. His wife was crippled up so bad, she didn't show up until we got in the buggy. No cars in those days in 1905. I rode with them to their home, which was at the edge of town. It consisted of an acre, had a big barn where they kept a horse and a cow. Also had chickens and hogs. An orchard was in one corner of the lot. The barn had a hay mow, and connected to it was the buggy shed. There was lots of room to play, and I was so happy to be free and go all over the place. I climbed the trees and anything else to climb on, such as the barn. After being pent up in the orphanage, it was like heaven. I had lots of pets, cats, a dog, and even the chickens and pigs were pets to me. I roamed all over for about 2 years. Then Mr. Million bought a farm of 160 acres and we moved. Again, I had lots of playmates. When we lived in town, I had a playmate named Belle Hunter. She lived up the hill from me. Her folks had several acres and big buildings. We climbed all those buildings.
You know, you cannot ask for a better endorsement for the orphan train system.
Yeah, yeah. Mamie's story was a happy one in general. Yeah.
And let's get now to your grandmother and her experience.
Yes, Grandma came out, as I said, in 1906, in March of 06, on the orphan train. Was initially bound for Hopkinton, Iowa. On the way out, they stopped in Chicago, which was often the case. They had to switch rail lines there and go on finally to their western destination. The minister that brought my grandmother out on the train was asked by some friends if they could have a little girl, and he asked them to meet him at the train station on their way through where they could take their pick. And after conversing with this Parker family, these friends of the minister, my grandmother stepped forward and declared that she'd like to go home with them. And hence she was left in Chicago and didn't ever make it out to Hopkinton, Iowa with the rest of the children. As it turns out, Mrs. Parker had developed a tumor and heart condition within months after taking my grandmother, and they had to give her up. So she was sent back on the orphan train. Reverend Clark had found her a new home in Iowa. That home lasted just a matter of 6 months as well. She didn't get along with the little boy in the home, and Reverend Clark was once again called to find her a new home. And the next home was up in Malone, Iowa, very eastern, extreme eastern part of Iowa there, with a family that had two teenage boys. And my grandmother lasted about a year at this home before trouble arose, and Reverend Clark was summoned by either a teacher or the authorities there where she was sent. He was informed that they were not clothing her and not sending her to school as their contract called for. So she was removed from that home, sent to another home in northeastern Iowa at Lansing with a young couple that farmed there. And they kept her about a year and a half and were going to attend a religious camp meeting in the woods near Waukon, Iowa, and took my grandmother with them and ended up leaving in the middle of the night without her. So they abandoned her at this religious camp meeting, and Reverend Clark was once again called to come and replace her.
And does that happen very often, so far as we know, that the parents would just drop off the children just as their biological parents had done?
Well, fortunately, it's quite unusual for that to happen. My grandmother was just one of the unlucky kids that did not fare near as well as many of them, you know, did.
we have some other recollections too, but I was kind of wondering, you know, in a sense, what would be the difference between, you know, these children, especially, you know, the ones who were put to work, and say, you know, an indentured servant that you would find, you know, earlier before these orphan trains. What kind of rights, what kind of options did they have once they were placed?
You know, there's very little difference in so many of the cases. Unfortunately, the children were asked to write back to the Children's Aid Society twice a year and report on their well-being and, you know, how they were doing. And the agents that placed these kids would endeavor to visit them maybe once a year and follow up and make sure everything was okay. But for the vast majority, you know, they were just made to work on the farm. A lot of them, you know, became just labor on the farm. Very few were ever adopted, especially the ones sent out by the Children's Aid Society, as they tended to be older. The New York Foundling Hospital children, being ages 5 and under, were more apt to be adopted and fully accepted into the family than these Children's Aid Society kids. The Children's Aid Society, by their own estimation, said that 87% turned out very well of the kids that they had sent out on the trains.
Well, all in all, that would be a very good batting average. I'm not sure exactly, you know, where they came up with the statistic, but it does imply that this idea, strange as it is to us today, was working.
Yes, it for the most part, it did. And, you know, these kids had a better life. Even if they did work hard on the farm, they had a better life than what they would have had they stayed back in New York City.
Well, and that's something that we always have to take into account, isn't it? The difference between what life was like for people who lived in their family context. I mean, living on a farm, even in the, you know, 20th century, very difficult for those who weren't orphans.
Exactly.
And so the hard work in itself is not something that should be a kind of a blot against this whole system.
Correct.
Now, you've also picked reminiscences of Sarah Hunt, and she had a somewhat different trajectory, and we'll hear her story right after this. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Clark Kidder, who's telling us about orphan trains, a phenomenon that placed children, usually from big cities, out into the West, usually on farms, from the 1850s all the way up until the 1920s. And we've looked at a couple of case histories. One was Mamie Gunderson, later Mamie Gunderson Rose, who seems to have settled into a fairly routine life. A long life at that, lived into her 90s. And then we also looked at Clark's grandmother's trajectory, and she proved to be one of those who was, for whatever reason, very hard to place, wound up settling with several families for short periods of time. And then we come to this third case that you've chosen, Clark, and that's Sarah Hunt, a.k.a. Sister Mary James.
Yes.
What happened there?
Very interesting story. She was sent out by the New York Foundling Hospital, or Asylum as it was known back then, as just a little tot of about 2, and sent to New Orleans in 1909, and later became Sister Mary James. It lived to be 98.
This is how she describes her early years.
I was born in the Bellevue Hospital, New York, in the year 1907. My mother died in giving me birth. I do not know whether my father left the hospital in sheer despondency or whether poverty drove him from the sight of his newborn. I was just left there, unclaimed. At the expiration of 2 months, according to the rule, I was placed in the hands of the Department of Public Charity, St. Ignatius Foundling Asylum, 175 East 68th Street, New York. Upon my arrival there, a Dominican priest from St. Vincent Ferrer's Church came over and baptized me. I was lovingly cared for by the good sisters of Mother Seton's congregation. The year 1909 found me on the train among 60 other tots, speeding away down to old New Orleans. We were out for adoption. Our foster parents and friends would be at the depot waiting to see what we looked like. Mr. James Faubacher of Crowley, Louisiana, a rich rice planter, wrote for a boy of 5 years. You know, a would-be heir to his vast plantation. So he and his brother, Mr. Peter Faubacher, eyed the babies as the train came to a standstill this sunny morning of April 30th. Caretakers and matrons were looking over the legal papers that were pinned to each baby's dress. After questions of identity, number 59 was put into the arms of Mr. Peter Faubacher, as Mr. James Faubacher was nowhere to be found. He, evidently, was looking for his boy of 5 years. Mr. Peter Faubacher, a father of 8 children, fell in love with this curly-headed cotton top of 1 year and 6 months. Her blue eyes danced with laughter and excitement. What did it all mean?
And trying to figure out exactly what was going through the minds of these two brothers, as one wanted a boy and was disappointed to see her, and then the other decided to take her.
Yes, yes. And the brother that ended up with her already had nearly a dozen children at home in his own family. So it was quite a heartwarming story. You know, he said that he certainly had room for one more child.
Interesting reason for wanting a child, and in specific a boy, that he wanted an heir for his plantation. That's one reason we haven't gotten into yet.
Yes, exactly. That was yet one more reason that someone might take a child. I suspect that it's one of the less common reasons that they would take a child, but you know, it was certainly a legitimate reason, at least in the minds of many of the folks that did so.
And it sounds as if she has this recollection of being pretty well tied to the church, even as a baby.
Yes, yes. They were very careful to find Catholic homes for these little babies that were sent out by the Catholic hospital, whereas the Children's Aid Society was primarily a Protestant organization. Even so, they would occasionally get a Catholic baby and, you know, would not endeavor to find a Catholic home for that child. They would just, you know, in most cases, place that child in a Protestant home. And, you know, it caused a little strife between the two organizations.
So the Catholics decided to set up their own.
Exactly, yeah.
And the girl who would later become Sister Mary James says this later in life.
Finally, the crowds began moving away. The train slowly picked up speed. Mr. James Faubacher came back to where his brother stood. He was sorely disappointed. Was he to return to his wife in Crowley, Louisiana, without his would-be son? What did he want with a girl? His old wife couldn't begin all over again with a year and a half old baby. The train had gone, so there was only one thing to do. Bring her home. As if the baby had sensed his disappointment and displeasure, she was reluctant in going to Mr. James Faubacher. She refused to leave the loving arms of Mr. Peter Faubacher. She slapped and kicked Mr. James Faubacher and cried to break her heart. Now Mr. James Faubacher was truly heartsick. How will she ever love me? It's no use. I'll take her back on the next train. The chubby little face, surrounded by ringlets, had captivated the heart of Mr. Peter Faubacher. I'll bring her home. The more the merrier. So, late that evening, Mr. Peter Faubacher greeted his wife with the new arrival. The marvel of it all was a baby about 2 years was toddling on the floor, a younger baby in mother's arms, and another was expected in June. What courage! Sisters and brothers ranging from 18 years on down gathered around the little stranger, who'd already made herself very much at home. Mother's cares and anxieties were relieved as two maiden aunts, sisters of Mrs. Peter Fabacher, strove with untiring care and love to replace a mother's devotion. I was always introduced as our little adopted sister. Years and years rolled by, and quite naturally, I experienced that utter loneliness. Who am I? Is my father still living? If so, where is he? Perhaps I shall die with that natural curiosity in my heart.
And that raises a question, Clark, having to do with how much were these children told about their backgrounds?
Well, they were told very little, to be honest. I think that the Foundling Hospital would typically send a little envelope with family history in it and some background information on the children they sent out, whereas the Children's Aid Society encouraged a complete break with the biological family and even discouraged these children from bringing any keepsakes or mementos with them that would link them to their biological family. And therefore, you know, many of them never reunited with parents or siblings ever again. My grandmother did make a trip back to New York in 1929 and was able to meet many of her biological siblings. Her father had perished in 1912 from cancer. We don't know what happened to her mom. I've never been able to find out what happened to her.
Well, we've been saying that these trains ran from the 1850s up until, and I think there's even a specific date given, 1929, for the last orphan train.
Yes.
If they were so successful, why did they come to a stop?
Well, as I had mentioned earlier, many of these states enacted laws prohibiting the interstate transportation of these kids, but more so various social, you know, child welfare laws that were passed. President Roosevelt championed a lot of those very early on, 1910, 11 perhaps. Many think the 1929 date coincides with the big crash, you know, at the stock market and so forth. But it was really a change in laws and just a feeling that children should remain with their biological parents, you know, ideally, and not be separated from them. You know, it's a philosophy that is still around today, of course.
And so the return was what, to, in effect, what, an orphanage that would somehow work more closely with the parents, assuming they could be found and were cooperative?
Correct. Correct. Yeah, they would endeavor to keep them with the biological parents if at all possible. And, of course, it wasn't possible in many cases. You know, the parents had died or through neglect, you know, they had to give the children up. And they were just placed, you know, within the state that they were located in rather than sent out on these trains. Foster parents were found in the immediate area for these kids, such as they do today for the most part.
Was the orphan train concept sort of thing that was of its time? In other words, I can't imagine now sending a train out, even with all kinds of scrutiny, to some place in the West where there'd be endless space.
Yes, exactly. It was a different time and different era, different mindset, and certainly a pioneering effort to deal with homeless and abandoned children.
So the scorecard for these orphan trains, as strange and awful in some ways as they seem to us today?
Well, you know, I feel that their intentions were good and the results in the vast majority of cases were good and positive, you know, and provided an alternative to these lives they would have lived in the inner cities. And in most cases, you know, my grandmother's case aside, they turned out really well and lived good, productive lives.
Well, Clark Kidder, thanks for sharing your experiences and insights into that phenomenon known as the orphan train.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Clark Kidder is the author of Orphan Trains and Their Precious Cargo and Emily's Story, The Brave Journey of an Orphan Train Rider. I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air.
Sending us out on the orphan train to try and find someone to take us in. Take us in. We have rode the orphan train. Take us in. We need a home. We need a name. Take us in. Oh, won't you be our kin? We are looking for someone to take us in. City streets, I've swamped the bars and pools for a little bite to eat. In my daddy's old green jacket and these rags on my feet, I'm just looking for someone to take me in. Take us in. We have rode the orphan train. Take us in. We need a home. We need a name. Take us in. Oh, won't you be our kin? We are looking for someone to take us in. Sit quietly until the food was blessed, and they put us on the orphan train, sent us way out west to try and find someone to take us in. Take us in. We have our own orphan train. Take us in. We need a home. We need a name. Take us in. Oh, won't you be our kin? We are looking for someone to take us in. Some living lost and found, and one by one we all were taken in. Take us in. We have rode the orphan train. Take us in. We need a home. We need a name. Take us in. Oh, won't you be our kin? We are looking for someone to take us in. Now there's many a fine doctor or teacher in your school. There's many a good preacher who can teach the golden. Who started out an orphan, sleeping in the freezing rain, whose life began out on the orphan train. Take us in. We have rode the orphan train. Take us in. We need a home. We need a name. Take us in. Oh, won't you be our kin? We are looking for someone to take us in. Take us in. Oh, won't you be our kin? We are looking for someone to take us in.